you believe. Assault is an act, not an adjective. Your safety is not just on the gun, it is the gun. Freedom is a fundamental human right. Welcome to your show, Two-Way Radio with Bill Cards. Your safety is your responsibility, not the government's, not anybody else's. Be a citizen, not a subject. Better yet, be a listener, because it's an inalienable right, not a privilege. The Two-Way Radio Show with Bill Carnes is live right now. Call 1-800-313-9443.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the show. We talk about the different mass shootings that go on around the country. Oftentimes, they happen in a place of worship, some sort of church or synagogue or something along that lines. And here's a little story for you. I shared a story with you within, I don't know, the last week or two, about a lady in Detroit who was at 5:30 in the morning getting gas. Two bad guys come up and rob her, and she takes out her gun and starts shooting. One of the bad guys ends up dead. Here's another story out of Detroit. A retired police officer turned pastor shot and wounded a man who broke into his Detroit church, police said this last Monday. Lawrence Adams went to the Westside Bible Church on Sunday evening and found the intruder inside the building, said, Detroit Police Sergeant Aaron Steffens. The man began swinging an object at the retired police lieutenant, who pulled out a handgun and shot him in the abdomen. The pastor identified himself as a retired policeman. The guy kept swinging. Adams' wife, Iris, told the Associated Press on Monday that the pastor, who was not injured, was licensed to carry a handgun. Well, actually, the interesting thing is there is a federal law that says anyone who is a current law enforcement officer or a duly retired law enforcement officer can carry concealed throughout the country. That's really the only national permit there is, if you're current or retired law enforcement. Now, he may also have some sort of Michigan CCW, but if he's retired, he's got a badge, he doesn't need it. Police have not released the alleged intruder's name, but said he was being treated in area hospital. His injuries were not believed to be life-threatening. We'll talk about that in a little bit. Iris Adams said the church's security company called her at home Sunday after the burglar alarm at the building was triggered. She telephoned her husband, who went to the church with his sister. She said, "The non-denominational church has had a burglar in the past. Normally, they would break in one of our windows," Iris Adams said. "Our alarm has always gone off." Lawrence Adams retired in 2006 after 25 years with the police department and was promoted to senior pastor at the church, where the couple had been members for several years in 2007, according to his wife. So, there we go with somebody breaking into a church. Now, it wasn't during a service, but it was to do whatever he was going to do. Pastor comes and shows up, identifies himself, guy starts swinging an object at the guy. He shoots him, hitting him in the abdomen. Now, for those of you who need a little bit of a biology lesson, that is basically in the gut. If you got a beer belly, it would be just about in the center of that. That's the abdomen. Not an efficient place to shoot somebody. Not with a handgun. It's just not. It's a very, very painful way to go, but it's not necessarily a stopper. All right? If you might remember the old school targets, I remember quite specifically one of the Dirty Harry films where Dirty Harry Callahan is firing at a target, and it's centered up right in the center of the belly before they really started realizing that's not a good place to shoot. And of course, if you mash a shot and it goes lower, where's it going to go if you aim to the chest and mash? It'll go to the abdomen. If you're aiming at the abdomen and you mash, where's it going to go? That's right. Somebody's going to be singing soprano. You want to shoot to the chest. We'll talk more about that after the break. Stay tuned. I'm your host, Bill Carnes, on 2A Radio.
Rule 1, assume it's loaded. Rule 2, don't point it at anything you're not willing to destroy. Rule 3. Listen to the 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes. 1-800-313-9443.
So again, we have the story of the former police lieutenant. He's a retired police lieutenant, shooting and injuring an intruder who broke into the church. And when he confronted the guy, when the pastor confronted the guy, he started swinging objects at him. So he shot him, hit him in the abdomen. Again, there's really not much in the way of vital organs down there, with one exception. We're talking the liver. The liver, the pancreas, and the spleen are the three different organs within the human body that do not expand and contract. When they expand, they stay that way. Expanding and contracting helps with the healing process. The spleen, the pancreas, the liver do not offer that. So if you shoot somebody in the liver, well, that's actually a potentially deadly shot right there. I mean, the liver is not something that you want to get shot in. However, finding it and shooting it, most people really aren't even sure where the heck it is. It pays to know your anatomy. Shooting in the gut, man, that's a painful sort of affair. If you see people who've actually been shot in the stomach, you know people who've been, or meet people who've been shot in a couple different areas, one of them's been in the stomach or gut, in the abdomen, they'll tell you it's very painful. Doesn't necessarily take them out. As a matter of fact, it's pretty poor shot placement. However, it is painful. So not really the area you want to go. I've talked about it before. You really want to, when you do shot placement, your goal is the center of the rib cage area in the thorax. That's really what you're looking for. So there's the analogy. And by the way, kudos to the pastor, the former police lieutenant, who and oftentimes when you get up in rank in a police department, you are not going to see the hierarchy, a lieutenant above, oftentimes even sergeant, but more so lieutenant above, where they're ever going to get involved in any kind of a shooting. Generally, detectives are very low probability of getting in any kind of a shooting. It's often the high-risk guys first, like SWAT or narcotics, gang unit guys. They're most likely, percentage-wise, to get into shooting. And then it's just the regular old beat cop. The cops that are out there on patrol in their sectors and they're doing the beat, those are the guys that are next in line most likely to get into a shooting. You get to sergeants, lieutenants, certainly captains, commanders like that, chances are almost non-existent that they'll get involved in a shooting unless it's a really, really small town and the guys with rank have to do regular patrolling duties as well. Generally, when you get into the cities, you've got all the patrol officers who are headed by a sergeant, and you'll have more than one squad out there at a time. Each squad is headed by a sergeant, and then they've got, you know, it might be six, it might be a dozen, it might be two dozen officers that they watch over. Depends on the city and how they stack it up. And quite honestly, the cities that have one sergeant in charge of a lot of officers, they're interested in having more officers on the street rather than promoting and having too many chiefs and not enough Indians, generally speaking. So then after you've got two or three or four, five, six squads that are out there working at any one time, you have a lieutenant over that. And then normally you'd have a captain over the three shifts that go on from there. That's usually where the hierarchy works within the police departments. So just to give you a little bit of an idea on how that sort of thing goes. So for this guy to get into shooting, he ended up having to retire. Here's a story saying local police, not soldiers. Let me read this to you. In response to an article regarding the creation of a charitable fund to support the Lompoc Police Department, I find it just nutty that the police would want to use that money to buy silencers for their weapons instead of items such as body armor or communications gear. Police have absolutely no business owning sound suppressors for any of their weapons, let alone for a sniper rifle. The only valid government possession of that type of hardware is in the hands of our armed forces. Local police are supposed to be public servants and police officers, not soldiers. The public isn't being served or the peace isn't being maintained when suppressed weapons are being used against us. The mindset of, for both the police and the military are supposed to be totally different. They're supposed to approach a problem from complete opposite ends of the spectrum, yet more and more frequently, you find the same mentality arising in law enforcement that you do among our soldiers. We the people are frequently regarded as the enemy by the current slate of police officers. In my lifetime, I have witnessed the police develop an ever more antagonistic and militaristic posture toward the public. A perfect example of the development of this trend is to use the catchphrase, such as the war on drugs or the war on crime. This terminology only serves to include a sense of antagonism and aggressiveness towards the public. Unfortunately, this mindset will be further inflamed by the possession of military equipment, which will only serve to further obliterate the distinction between police and military. I experienced firsthand during 15 years of Army service the aggressive spirit fostered by the issuance of high-tech pieces of military hardware. If the police want to play Rambo, they should join the military. I hope that no one would be foolish enough to contribute to this fund when this is how their money is going to be spent, and I will do all of my power to discourage people from donating as long as the funds are to be used for this. Stephen Lyons, Sr. of Lompoc. I believe Lompoc is New Jersey. I don't know. I think it's New Jersey. Interesting letter. Very good points. Very well constructed. I like it. I have one thing I would like to contradict that he said. He said the public isn't being served or peace isn't being maintained when suppressed weapons are being used. Actually, the peace will be maintained if there's not loud shots ringing out. If they're quieter, why bother the neighbors? That's really all I have to say about it. Now, I'll tell you this. A lot of people don't know this. I own a suppressor. I own a multi-caliber suppressor. And, you know, I've gone through all the proper forms and everything. And in Nevada, it's very easy to get a Class 3 piece of gear. Class 3 being defined as, essentially, fully automatic or a suppressor. And you can have a fully automatic gun and a suppressor on it, as long as you register both the fully automatic receiver and suppressor that's on it, even if it's an integral suppressed barrel. I have a suppressor that will suppress subsonic and supersonic. It's actually designed specifically as a supersonic suppressor. And it will do 22 caliber up to about a 35 caliber. I can actually shoot a 9mm through the thing. But I can shoot a 22 long rifle, a 223, a 22-250. I have actually fired many of my 22-250 rounds through it. I can thread it onto my 308. It's designed as a multi-caliber suppressor. And I had it built by a guy named Don Wagenknecht of Ozark Armory in Missouri. Don is a great guy. He has developed certain suppressor technologies that are unreal. A good friend of mine liked it so much, he ordered a suppressor from Don along the same specs. However, he ordered his, he wanted his to be as light as weight as possible, so Don forged the thing out of bar stock aluminum. Mine's made out of steel, so mine's a little bit heavier than my buddy's, but it's got the same sound suppressing capabilities. And I'm happy that mine's heavier. I don't need a lighter one because I'm a little bit more rough with my gear. My gear has to stand up to the test of time. Anyhow, the interesting thing about suppressors that a lot of people don't know is when it's on a rifle and you shoot without a suppressor, just having a crowned muzzle, which, by the way, a 60-degree crown tends to be the way most gun manufacturers, barrel manufacturers are going. They're cutting it about a 60-degree crown because it's the way that it's changing the direction of the gases is less effective on the rear of the bullet, creating what's called a yaw. As the tip of the bullet flies forward, the back of the bullet wobbles a bit. And changing the crown will change the amount that it wobbles and reduce it down. The interesting thing with using a suppressor, that wobble is almost completely eliminated, thus tightening groups. It's happened on every rifle I've fired mine with, and Don told me to expect it. Don actually fired, if I can remember correctly, it was an inch and a half group, I believe it was, at about 400 yards. Now, Don's a good shooter, but the thing is it was, he was using the same hold, the same aim the same techniques as any other shooter who happened to be out there shooting that day. It's just he had a suppressor on the end of his barrel, which created no yaw, literally no yaw, on the back of the bullet. Therefore, he shot a tighter group than everybody else, simply because of adding that suppressor on there. Now, he said on any other day, he would have shot a 3 or 4 inch group without a suppressor. Thread the suppressor on there. It eliminates that gases. The baffles in the suppressor slow those gases down, so the bullet is able to leave a confined space, which is now no longer the muzzle. The confined space is now the far end, the business end of the suppressor, while the gases are still inside it being trapped, and hence the sound is then suppressed. It's not called a silencer, by the way. It's called a suppressor because it doesn't silence anything. There's no such thing as a silent shot. There is a suppressed shot, and you can get them really quiet, but there's still noise. Anyhow, that really helps to increase accuracy. I experienced that with my .22-250. I mean, I was able to, with my hand loads, shoot about a half-inch group, maybe three-quarter-inch group. With that on there, at 100 yards, all three rounds will touch. And the only difference is I put the suppressor on there. Point of impact's a little different, but you have to adjust for that. Anyhow, there's a little bit of information. It was a good letter, but a little suppressor technology I wanted to talk about. More after the break. Stay tuned.
Have the alcohol and tobacco. Leave the firearms to us. Right now, live, the 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes.
There's a guy in Yuba City, California, who used a handgun to fend off three burglars who invaded his home and endangered his life. Here's the story. Police say that two females and one male broke into David Macy, Yuba City's California home. Macy reportedly discovered one of the female home invaders in his kitchen, grabbed his gun, and chased the suspect from his home. What sort of stereotypical thing is that? You find a strange woman in your home and she migrates to the kitchen? What kind of goofiness is that? The suspects are said to have gotten into a Ford Explorer parked in Macy's circular driveway, then driven the vehicle towards Macy, prompting him to fire into the vehicle in an attempt to stop it and save himself. The Explorer rolled on its side, and the passengers fled on foot through a nearby prune orchard. Too bad it wasn't a briar patch. Police reportedly arrested three suspects nearby a short while later. Detectives said that they have discovered jewelry boxes and other suspected stolen items in the crashed vehicle, and are investigating whether the suspects were involved in multiple burglaries. Massey was unharmed, while the two female suspects were treated at a local hospital for injuries believed to have been sustained when the SUV crashed, according to police. So it sounds like they had this SUV, whether it was Macy's or somebody else's, and they were grabbing stuff and throwing it in there. That's where they were stashing or, you know, putting all of it, which makes sense. It turns out that Mr. Macy's last encounter with home invaders also ended in a self-defense gun use. On July 2, 2008, Massey reportedly fired his handgun at a suspect burglar fleeing in a pickup truck and also held another alleged burglar at gunpoint until police arrived. Once again, gun ownership has allowed a homeowner to defend himself against a numerically superior alleged attackers. I like how they say alleged. You have to use alleged nowadays to avoid any sort of liable lawsuit. So you're not liable for what you have to use the word alleged. Like I can say, allegedly, President Obama, blah, da, 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 da. And go on with some otherwise, defamating sort of statement. But if I use allegedly in there, then I'm okay. Had Mr. Massey not been armed, he may have been harmed while in his home or run down by an SUV in his own driveway. Luckily, Mr. Massey was armed and managed to eject three intruders from his home and avoid being run down in his driveway. Society also seems to have benefited from this self-defense, since three alleged home invading robbers and a suspected getaway vehicle are now in police custody. Armed self-defense works, plain and simple. Had this guy not been armed with a gun, what could he have done against a numerically superior number of people? What could he have done? Well, who knows? Probably not much. Unless you're some sort of extreme cage fighter, you might be able to take on a guy and two women. There is a relatively highly viewed video on YouTube. And it's redneck, to say the least. You got two young, skinny rednecks. You know, small guys. They're brothers, and they're small. They're shorter, they're thinner, they're wiry, they're not very muscular, tatted up, just redneck boys. Going up against fighting a very big, strong, powerful redneck guy. And it was in a range fight. It's like everybody goes down and they do this fight. I don't know if they're getting money or for it or something or what, but it's a sport of sorts, wherever these guys are. Well, even though the big guy would have crushed, absolutely crushed, either one of the small guys, just because there was two of them, they ended up whipping the big guy in a new way. Absolutely whipped him. Because you got two against one, it's a numerically superior force. Now, unless you've got some really high-end, extreme training, those are bad odds. I direct you to something like aerial dogfighting. No pilot really wants to go up against two against one, in any sort of aerial dogfight. However, there are pilots, basically any fighter pilot in the U.S. military, be it in the U.S. Air Force, the Marine Corps, or the Navy, they're going to be able to take out two of any standard Air Force sort of fighter pilot around the world. The best trained pilots are generally American and Israeli. The Russians are pretty good. French are okay. The British are pretty darn good. You get away from that, you get into more of the third world, and they might have the equipment, but they don't understand the aerial dogfighting technique. So you have somebody who's highly trained against a numerically superior force, they can beat them. Such was the case when you had the carrier-based Harrier jump jets on the Her Majesty's kind of the shorter Harrier carriers that they have during the Falklands War with the Argentinian Air Force. They didn't lose a single Harrier, and they shot down a couple dozen Argentinian planes, just the way it goes. So anyhow, this guy in California using the gun, right answer, right way of using it. Stay tuned, more to come.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Radio with Bill Carnes, 1-800-313-9443.
I want to play for you a file. It's about 5 minutes, and it is regarding the abuses of the Patriot Act. The Patriot Act, or portions thereof, are up for potential renewal. And this has a senior Justice Department official answering questions to a senator. And it's amazing the revelations that come out of it. Listen to this.
Chris, let me start by reiterating something you and I have talked about previously, and that's my concern that critical information about the implementation of the Patriot Act has not been made public. information that I believe would have a significant impact on the debate. I urge you to move expeditiously on the request that I and others in this committee have made before the legislative process is over. Now, in Suzanne Spaulding's testimony for the next panel, she argues that additional safeguards are needed in the context of intelligence investigations because of the very broad scope of intelligence investigations, the secrecy with which they must be conducted, and the fact that they often do not lead to prosecution. That is, we have to take into account that safeguards inherent to criminal investigations are simply not always present in the context of intelligence investigations. Mr. Christ, do you agree that additional vigilance is needed in the context of intelligence investigations?
Yes.
And in fact, isn't that what was demonstrated, at least in part, by the IG reports on national security letters?
Well, I think the problems that Ms. Define found are significant. I think they've been remedied. I'm not sure that those are inherent in an intelligence use of NSLs, but, I mean, certainly they are significant and they warrant attention, and I think they've gotten a lot of attention.
Mr. Fine, would you agree that the lack of safeguards contributed to the misuse of NSLs?
I think to some extent the fact that they were not transparent does produce an environment where there needs to be more significant vigilance.
Mr. Chris, as you know, the Patriot Act provided statutory authority for the government to obtain a special sneak and peek criminal search warrants that allow agents to break into Americans' homes and conduct secret searches without telling them for weeks, months, or even longer. It is true, isn't it, that these searches can be conducted also in run-of-the-mill criminal cases and do not require any connection to terrorism?
That's true, both before...
And in fact, according to a July 2009 report of the Administrative Office of the U.S. Courts, isn't that exactly how this authority has most recently been used? The report shows that in fiscal year 2008, sneak and peek search warrants were requested 763 times, but only three of those initial requests, just three, were in terrorism cases. The vast majority were for drug cases. Now, is that your understanding of that report, and does it concern you at all?
It is my understanding, and I want to say thank you to your staff who alerted me and allowed me to read the report in advance of this hearing. It does say here that 65% of these are criminal sneak and peek, were in drug cases. Obviously, just to make something clear, which I know you understand, on the FISA side, the searches that we do pursuant to FISA are not exactly sneak and peek. They're generally covert altogether. So this authority here on the sneak and peek side, on the criminal side, is not meant for intelligence. It's for criminal cases. So I guess it's not surprising to me that it applies in drug cases.
As I recall, it was in something called the USA Patriot Act, which was passed in a rush after an attack on 9/11 that had to do with terrorism. It didn't have to do with regular run-of-the-mill criminal cases. And let me tell you why I'm concerned about these numbers. That's not how this was sold to the American people. It was sold, as stated on DOJ's website in 2005, as being necessary, quote, to conduct investigations without tipping off terrorists. I'm going to say it's quite extraordinary to grant government agents the statutory authority to secretly break into Americans' homes in criminal cases, and I think some Americans might be concerned that it's been used hundreds of times in just a single year in non-terrorism cases, and that's why I'm proposing additional safeguards to make sure that this authority is available where necessary, but not in virtually every criminal case, and also to shorten the time period for notification.
Well, I don't mean to quibble with you. I do want to just point out one thing, which is before, and I was trying to carve out FISA, just to clarify that FISA is a different authority where it is covert. And also, if I'm correct on this, I believe two courts of appeals prior to the Patriot Act had authorized sneak and peek under existing law. This was,
yes,
I think, meant to be a codification.
Some
of that
courts
doctrine
permitted secret searches in limited circumstances before the Patriot Act, as I remember from the debate, but they also recognized the need for prompt notice unless a reason to continue to delay the notice was demonstrated, and they specifically said that notice had to occur within 7 days, which is what we fought for at the time of the Patriot Act, which is what our bill proposes. So I think you make a fair point that it was allowed to some extent, but without these protections, this is a dramatic change in our general criminal law that doesn't necessarily relate to terrorism. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Now, I got to tell you, that is disturbing to realize that what's happened in the past is happening again. You give somebody an inch, and they're going to take a mile if they have an agenda. They have an agenda, and they ask for a little bit. You give them that little bit, and they are going to run with it. So we all know that the provisions of the Patriot Act have been abused by the police, by the district or federal attorney's offices, and by the courts to a certain extent as well. Because they're using provisions that are meant to stop terrorism and using them for common criminal things. So we gave them an inch, they've taken them out, to the tune of the average of about one out of every 255 of these sneak and peek warrants. One out of every 255, less than 0.4%, were actually for the intended cause. If they went specifically by the intent of the Patriot Act, only 3 search warrants would have happened last year. That's it. 3. Not 763 or whatever the number was. Roughly 255 search warrants, 254 go with that inch, that mile that was taken from the inch before it's actually used for what it was intended for. So it would seem as though, with that information being out there and the Justice Department now admitting it, yes, you're right. And by the way, thank you for sending that to us. Okay, he sounded like he was actually interested and genuinely thankful that the senator's office sent over these numbers before he got there so he could actually be informed and not blindsided, which often happens in front of any sort of congressional hearing. So, good information on that. I am glad it went down that way. So, let's see where this takes us. Let's see what happens to any of the provisions of the Patriot Act. I have a feeling it's probably going to get more and more and more narrowed because there's more and more and more abuses of it. We can only hope. Here's a story out of Newark, New Jersey. Newark officials unveil a 3-part strategy to prevent gun violence. Now, listen to this. There is no graver threat to Newark's reputation or bigger obstacle to its economic success than gun violence, according to these politicians. Fear deadens neighborhoods and scares off visitors. While statistics show Newark homicides and shootings have declined, any spree of violence or highly publicized shooting brings the perception that the city is a dangerous place in every corner. Fear rules, justified or not. When an innocent bystander, especially children, are caught in the crossfire, or when running gun battles leave multiple victims, the statistics lose luster as signs of hope. Instead of grief of loved ones, the fear of neighborhoods and the banners of yellow police tape mark the harsh realities of gun crime. In the coming weeks, Newark Police and the Essex County Prosecutor's Office will unveil a major new gun strategy to get illegal guns and the people who use them off the streets. Basically, there are about 3 elements. Intercept guns coming into the streets, get the guns in the city off the streets, and get more convictions in gun cases, said Gary McCarthy, Newark's police director. The biggest change will be the way gun cases are handled. The Newark police will use 2 detectives to investigate every gun taken off the street, and 2 assistant prosecutors will be assigned to take those cases into court. It doesn't matter if the gun was used in a crime or taken from a guy drinking a beer on a corner. Once the gun falls into the hands of police, it will be investigated like any major crime. McCarthy calls it enhancement. The focus will be on making weapons possession charges stick and tracking how the guns got into the city. McCarthy said teaming detectives with prosecutors is an enormous step in getting more convictions. Here's a quote. This way, there will be shared expertise. We'll know exactly what they need to bring a strong case to court, according to McCarthy. Things like good fingerprints, airtight evidence, procedures, and reliable witnesses will be employed. In the past, weapon charges have often downgraded or been dismissed to clear the court of more serious crimes. For a while, Essex County weapons charges were often remanded to municipal courts like less serious misdemeanors. Earlier this year, the state upgraded weapons possession to a second-degree offense, which is illegal parlance, which in legal parlance brings it a presumption of incarceration. The rest of us would call that jail time. With stronger cases, authorities will be able to move weapons charges into federal courts. Federal convictions mean longer sentences and incarceration in faraway penitentiaries. Carolyn Murray, the Essex County first assistant prosecutor, said the Newark police strategies comes at the perfect time because of the harsher state penalties and the U.S. attorney's willingness to make federal cases based on prior records of defendants. We do sentence analysis on our cases to see where defendants will be dealt with more severely, she said. Stronger cases will allow us to confidently bring cases to the court with the highest penalties. McCarthy said another front on the new strategy is developing intelligence through weapons traces. The state police e-trace program has the bugs worked out, allowing every New Jersey police force to get trace information from the ATF. The city will then set up its own database of gun registries. That whole thing concerns me. We will find the circumstances in which the weapon got to town, according to McCarthy. We'll treat it the way we treat narcotics investigations. We'll see where the guns are coming from and where they're going, and we'll set up things like undercover buys. The new database will also help police track and place the high risk of violence, according to McCarthy. He says, this is the police director, we're using a series of filters to flag certain cases. People with two previous felonies, or one arrest for unlawful weapons possession, or someone with an involvement in gun violence over the past 2 years. This includes people who were shot because they have to look for the possibility of retaliation. In the neighborhoods or corners where there is a history of gun violence, police will do more what they call quality of life stops looking for weapons. That means a Fifth Amendment violation. It's okay. No big deal. It makes sense for us to look at for people in places. It makes sense for us to look at people in places that keep showing up as problems. That's profiling. I've said before many times profiling exists because it works. They're not trying to say, okay, what's going on in this area so I can find a way to harass the people. They're like, no. Something's going on in this area. We need to look into it. So that's a good thing. Newark police took 374 guns off the streets last year, slightly more than one a day, up from 347 the year before. Is that an extra 28 guns. Those are 374 potential shootings, 374 potential homicides, McCarthy said. Every gun we take out the street, in my book, becomes a crime that does not happen. Now, let me comment on this. First of all, the idea, effort, and I believe the foundation for this plan are all excellent. Because what they're looking at is getting illegal guns off of the street that are possessed by people who are criminals, people who are of the criminal element that would use these guns for illegal means, and hence give the good, honest, law-abiding people like you and I a bad name because they're using guns that are acquired illegally, possessed illegally, and used illegally off the street. What concerns me is that this, again, inch to a mile. That's why we did the Patriot Act thing first before I got to this story. An inch before a mile. Will they use this to get some sort of small paperwork-related infraction against an otherwise honest law-abiding gun owner? For instance, let's say that somebody's got a rifle in his truck. He's driving down southern New Jersey. He's going to go do some hunting. And in New Jersey, you can't have a round in the chamber when it comes to having a rifle or shotgun in your vehicle. But let's say somebody does. And then they get prosecuted by this. That would be an abuse, just as an example. So they're going to intercept the guns coming into the city, get the guns off the streets, and get more convictions in gun cases. I couldn't agree more. The way they're looking at doing this, when they get these guns, they're going to try and find out where they came from. Now, what really bothers me is this whole e-check thing. I'd like to know a little bit more about that. If anybody knows about this New Jersey e-trace program, the state police e-trace program has the bugs worked out, allowing every New Jersey police force to get trace information from the ATF. The city will then set up its own databases of gun histories. Now, that concerns me a little bit. If it's as simple as the ATF knows where it goes from manufacturer to wholesaler to distributor to retailer, They know that trace. Once beyond that, the 4473 form would show where it went, but you got to go to the retailer to find out. That would involve having the ATF be actively involved in these cases. Now, keep in mind, 374 in this last year, that's about one a day. Not too big of a deal. And this is just in the city of Newark. This sounds like, on the surface, a very reasonable, well-thought-out, well-decided plan. Provided the honest law-abiding people are not part of some bigger umbrella picture. There's got to be the checks and balances. And unfortunately, history's shown there are not checks and balances. If they can control themselves in this, which I should say if they can be controlled in this, not controlling themselves, because we know that that will never happen. I believe this to be a really good idea because it takes street thug scumbags who already have convictions, now they have guns, they're living on, off, for, and by criminal activity, and it takes the guns away from them and puts them away where they belong so you and I don't become a victim of their lifestyle. I like the idea on the surface. I'm a little troubled by some of the statements and some of the aspects, but as a general rule, I like it. It'll be interesting to see where this goes within the next year. More to come after the break. Stay tuned.
Right to listen and take action shall not be infringed. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes is back. 1-800-313-9443. Uncle Sam's out here to shoot me.
Homework for everybody in the listening audience. This weekend, somebody's going to break into your house with a gun. I don't know what time of day it's going to be, but they're going to be hell-bent and intent on taking you and anybody else in your home, whether it be a house, a condo, an apartment, whether you live in a trailer or an RV, or in the backseat of your car. By the way, if you're living in the backseat of your car and you're listening to my show, I got to tell you, I really appreciate it. Somebody's going to break into your residence, where you live, while you are there this weekend, and they're going to be armed, and they don't really care about your life. They don't care about the life of anybody else living with you, be it a roommate, a spouse, a significant other, kids. They don't care. And they're going to be hell-bent on terrorizing you, taking what they can get, and if you give them any trouble, they're not going to have any trouble blowing you away. And they might just do it right off the bat, because they're going to be really high, really aggressive, and really doped up. That's going to happen this weekend. So my question to you is, are you prepared? Okay, how about this instead? It's not going to happen this weekend. It's going to happen next weekend. So you've got this weekend to prepare. What are you going to do? Do you know how to set up your home properly? Do you know how to set up different little things within your home to make it difficult for them? Do you have some sort of defense, some sort of response, some sort of game plan with the people in your home that you live with if you don't live by yourself? Do you have your own plan if you live by yourself? Do you have a plan with everybody else who lives there if you live with even a single other person? Do you have a plan? Do you know if you have a gun, do you know how to run it? Do you know about shot placement? Do you know about reloading it? Do you know about clearing malfunctions? Because if they're breaking in this weekend, well, you've got the rest of today to get it figured out. All of it. If they're breaking in next weekend, you've got 8 days. 8 lousy, miserable days to get it figured out. The reason I bring this up to you is that you never know when it's going to happen. But if you're told it's about to happen right now, many of you might be feeling a little bit of anxiety over what I've been saying so far the last couple of minutes. Because you're like, wow, I'm really not ready. Get on it. Get on it. There's a television program called The Colony. It was a 10-week program. I didn't watch it week by week by week. I waited for all 10 weeks to record on my DVR. Then I watched the entire thing. It was, I think, Tuesday this week. I watched all 10 shows. Of course, I could fast forward through the commercials. It took about 7 hours. And they prioritized things based on what they thought they should do. And whenever there was a security breach by a band of marauders, all of a sudden security finally became a number one. It happened 3 or 4 times during the process of these 10 weeks. They didn't start concentrating on security until they had a huge lapse and a huge breach of it. I would encourage you to learn from their mistakes and learn a little bit, if nothing else, about physical security of your home. I'd like to close by saying, to those of you within our government, we will be watching you in Congress, the executive, and judicial branches all very closely as we organize to save our freedom, liberty, and country. We will not become the subjects of governmental rule. I'd like you to do your homework this weekend and tell me what your plans are to get it together. Send me an email to bill@2aradio.com.
Bill will be here tomorrow. Will your freedoms? The 2A Radio Show, 7 a.m. Pacific, 9 Central, Monday through Friday.